Stu Does America.
Got so much to get to tonight. Glenn Beck's going to join us in a minute to catch up on the news and what he did over his vacation. But we're going to start by doing high-speed failures. Honestly, this is probably one of the longest stories I've ever covered in my entire life. In fact, I can bring you all the way back to, what was it, 2013. Okay, this is not one of the first episodes of this show, but one of the first episodes of my previous show. In fact, the first time we debuted, I believe, the TV for the head and the random legs under for interviews. the talking head, as we call it around here. It goes all the way back there, 2013. We're talking to a guest named Eric Christian about the just tragic, ridiculous project going on in California with high-speed rail.
It is the most expensive project in human history. No hyperbole aside, I don't even think the Great Pyramid of Giza cost this. Now, granted, they used a lot of slave labor back then, but if you had OSHA and you had a prevailing union wage on it, I still don't think it would be as expensive as the $68 gazillion choo-choo to nowhere here in California. So, yeah, it is the largest project in human history.
When it was first passed, it was supposed to cost how much?
$33 billion. It is shot up to $100 billion, and they realized that was not working too well with the public. So they got together, erased a few zeros, and put it down to $68 billion. But of course, we know it will come in somewhere north of probably $200 billion when this is all done. But, you know, it's just a few billion here, a few billion there. It's not real money.
The only controversial thing he says there is when it's all done, because I don't know that there's a moment it ever gets done. We updated the story many, many times over the years. In fact, on this program back in 2022, we talked to you about the newest cost estimates, and Eric seemed to be kind of right on the money as to what was going to happen here. Meanwhile, costs have continued to escalate. When the California High-Speed Rail Authority issued its new 2022 draft business plan in February, it estimated an ultimate cost as high as $105 billion. Less than 3 months later, the, quote, final plan, end quote, raised the estimate to $113 billion. So we're getting closer and closer to the $200 billion number. And we've more than, you know, what, four? We're about four times as much as it was supposed to cost from its original proposal. Now, there's a new piece out. This one is in the New York Times, and it goes through what actually went on along this route as they're trying to build this. And I just love the story because it's just the exact story you should know about government failure and how these things happen. Let me draw this one up for you. A scenic tour of red tape tracking the slowest high-speed train in the country. Again, to their credit, the New York Times is actually covering this. I don't know that anyone's picked up on it outside of us, but we're going to make sure it gets some attention that it deserves. Farmer John Deeper Sluts, crops are about 1,000 acres of stone fruits, peaches, apricots, and so much, and so on, including the patented varieties shipped daily during harvest season to Japan, Singapore, China, and elsewhere. The high-speed rail bed, a smooth, wide berm, trackless for now, cuts diagonally across those orchards. It carved up all the farmland, Mr. Deepersluth said, and it left a lot of remnant pieces that are useless. This is government policy in action. This is how it works every single time. A little bit more. This is a very strange choice they made at the beginning. Another issue still debated too late is why high-speed rail began construction in the middle of the route and not at the endpoints. Officials wanted to bring jobs to a chronically overlooked region and wanted to show progress quickly, hoping momentum would lead to more funding and support. And that's a key part here. They knew all the time they needed more than $33 billion. They knew it. They just hoped people would just continue to give them money, which, by the way, has happened. They have been getting more and more money, just not apparently enough. The rail route cut some dairies and farms in half. It split houses from their own barns. Bisected processing facilities. It turned some 100-year-old roads into dead ends. It stranded homeowners on inaccessible islands and forced farmers and their equipment to go miles out of the way simply to work their own land. Some schmuck 15 years ago said, "This is the route we're going to take," said Ruth Howarth, one of the clients this particular person in the interview was on his way to see, and they had no idea of the impact. Of course, you know, the truth is they don't care about the impact, really. I mean, whatever, you know, it's roll over your property, they roll over your property. They were taking it through eminent domain in the first place, against the will of many of these landowners. High-speed rail does not plan many stations, of course, with fewer stops and faster trains, but one is being built a couple of miles east of town atop a long viaduct about 60 feet high. Picture these communities. They're just farmlands, 60 feet high. and as long as an airport runway in such a rural setting, the pilings look out of scale and otherworldly. Mr. Wasser pointed out that where there's a small subdivision that had been moved out of the way, where a farmer lost 25 acres of cherry trees to a construction yard, where a cheese company was bumped off land it had bought 6 months earlier to expand its operation. And we talk about how businesses are affected by government policy. We've been doing it a lot lately with tariffs and other things. This is what happens, right? Like, you go, you buy land to build a processing facility. You're in the process of building that, and all of a sudden you get kicked off of it because some guy wants to build a train that you've never even, some guy you've never even met, to process people that you'll never meet, blazing through your town 60 feet in the air at 200 miles an hour. That, of course, will probably never actually happen. A road dead-ended at a future rail line, a swath of compacted dirt as wide as a highway in front of one of the region's biggest dairies, a 24-hour-a-day operation. A dozen construction workers in orange vests were preparing to bore a tunnel under the rail line. It will be big enough for semi-trucks and solely for one business, the dairy's use. That is part of a settlement being negotiated. The rail authority obtained its order of possession in 2019. Attorney Jan Kahn knows firsthand how high-speed rail's arrival can alter quiet lives in unassuming places. More than a decade ago, he attended a community meeting where high-speed rail officials unveiled maps of the proposed routes. Mr. Kahn's family lived in a century-old farmhouse outside of Hanford. Tell me if you think this would be a problem for you. He learned that the train line, would cut through his front porch. A rail official explained that the line in that area would be dug below grade. An old farmer overheard, "I hope you can swim." Because you can't really do that in certain areas. But of course, these people don't know this. This is a centrally planned project, and centrally planned projects go this way all the time. Of three district lagoons or retention ponds, the rail path now cuts two of them in half. Another is considered part of a wetland, which caused the rail authority to build another sky-high viaduct over what looks like nothing. Because it was technically one of these wetlands, but there was not really any water there, so they have a giant bridge over something that there's no water in. Rail construction has forced the lagoons to remain dry the past 2 years. That coincided with wet years, meaning no stored water in lots pumping for area farmers. Now, of course, there's a lot of excuses going around. Right? It's always somebody else's fault, certainly not government politicians' fault. Least of all, we know it can't possibly be Gavin Newsom's fault. Now, this happened before he was even in office, of course, it was passed, but it has not improved. He's not been able to successfully do anything here. So this is what his excuse was. Gavin Newsom was, I guess, on Real Time with Bill Maher. The host blamed lawyers, lobbyists, contractors, environmentalists, unions, and others. Notice not him, not another politician, but just others. The biggest delay on high-speed rail, Mr. Newsom replied, has been taking 2,270 properties under eminent domain. Maybe that's a signal that you shouldn't do that. And ultimately getting the environmental work cleared. Again, he is noting that the environmental work was a big problem here, and it was. It was a bold and pointed casting of blame for a project that is a running joke, a not running joke, and a punchline for government inefficiency and bureaucratic entanglement. Of course, he left out this little detail, which is in the story. The Rail Authority later declined to cite any examples in which right-of-way acquisition, a process that includes an eminent domain, caused delay to construction activities. They couldn't come up with one example. Remember, he said 2,270 properties were trying to take. They can't come up with one example where it actually slowed construction. But it noted many secondary reasons the project is so far behind schedule. So basically the way that process works is they say, hey, we're going to you, we're taking your property eminent domain. Then they give you an offer for your property, which is really crappy. And then the house owner says, we're not taking that. They go to court. But as they go to court, the way the law works is the government gets to keep building. So there was no delays at all for this. This is just a blatant lie. The bottom line is, this is my favorite story of all time, and I'm going to keep talking about it and bothering with you every single time there's a new update because I love it. Now, I got to go to somebody who's going to talk about his trip to Italy, and he had a lot of things he didn't love so much. Glenn Beck is next. In the time it takes to have a, you know, maybe Washington debate a single bill or maybe build a high-speed rail. FastGrowingTrees.com can transform your barren yard into a lush paradise that would make even Mother Nature jealous. Forget those weekend expeditions to overcrowded garden centers where you navigate through mazes of, you know, wilting specimens, only to haul dirt-caked purchases home in your once-clean car. FastGrowingTrees solves that problem. They deliver premium plants directly to your doorstep within days, ready to breathe life into that neglected corner of your property. Specimens grow up to six times faster than those sad seedlings languishing under fluorescent lights at big box stores, turning your outdoor space into a lush and tropical sanctuary from the relentless 2025 news cycle and news about high-speed rail developments. Their round-the-clock growing advice is awesome. I've used it before. It's great. They'll help you with, you know, whatever climate you're in, whatever you've invested in as far as the plants go. They're going to help them flourish with minimum effort on your part. And you don't screw it up like I would without their help. This spring, they are offering up to half off select plants, and viewers of the show receive an additional 15% off with your first purchase with the code STEW at checkout. It's fastgrowingtrees.com. Code is STEW. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. It's fastgrowingtrees.com. Fastgrowingtrees.com. The code is STEW. Well, here we are on the program STEW Does America, not in our normal studio.
It's too hot.
That is legitimately the reason we're sitting
it's
in
too
here.
Hot.
We're in the radio room.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to do your interview in the radio room today.
Yeah, because it's too hot.
Because our air conditioning is broken in the main studio.
It's like 80 in there. What are you, crazy?
Which is like great for me.
I know.
I'm loving it.
Yeah, I will melt.
I'm like
a chocolate Easter bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 80, I don't do well.
You don't do that. Now, you just came back from a continent that doesn't have any air conditioning.
Which is another reason why I'm not doing it anymore. It's America, damn you.
Yeah. If you ever wanted to be America first, visit Europe.
Visit Europe and just ask for a Coke or a Sprite and then see what they bring you. A hot Coke or Sprite with a glass, no ice. And you say, can I get some ice with this? And they're like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. Ice. What is? And you're like, it's not a complex recipe. Okay, it's really not.
Hydrogen.
Water.
Oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Water in the freezer. That's all you have to do.
Do they have freezers?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Did you actually, because you told a little bit of this story earlier with the ice, which I could see being incredibly frustrated. I love ice.
I love ice.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious, did you actually ask for ice and did they bring it?
No, some places did, you know, that love God.
Okay.
You know, the places that love God, they brought ice.
Uh-huh. There are still small sections of Europe that do this?
Just very few. But the ones that love God and that honestly we should be allies with. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
NATO allyship should be given really to restaurants or hotels that serve ice.
Right. Yeah. So we will defend a Russian invasion of a particular establishment.
Yeah, let's say the Four Seasons is attacked. Mm-hmm. We're there.
Okay.
We're there.
I like that.
You know, it's like Hotel Italia. No, we're not there. We're not there for you. You know, screw yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have ice.
Yeah.
You don't understand ice. You know, this is another one. I want to blow this up. This is another one. I was at a restaurant and I asked for a little water.
Turn it around the other way.
Okay. I asked for a little water. There's the glass. There's the glass. It's this big. It's a little water. I said, could I get a little water? And they gave me a shot glass of water.
Now you're holding that up to my camera. Why don't you hold it up to your camera? There you go. There you go. Now you can see it.
That's a little water. That's a little water.
It's smaller than your hand.
Yeah. It is literally a shot glass. I did it. Pounded it down on the table.
I think there could be some accusations.
Whatever they say.
People will think, you know, Glenn has gone off the wagon when you're drinking some clear liquid out of a very small glass.
it was the response. And could I get a little water?
And that was the water. A thimble of water.
A thimble of water.
All right.
They didn't have a thimble.
Now,
they just used a shot glass.
This was not the only thing that seemed to frustrate you on this trip. And you came back in, as you typically do off of vacation, with a lot to say. A
lot to say. Because my wife won't listen to me.
That is the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem. I've got 10 days of stuff nobody would listen to.
Millions of people listen to you on a daily basis.
My family? No.
Not involved.
Not even. Not just they won't listen. Not interested.
Not interested
not
at
interested.
All.
Yeah.
So what's it like going on vacation with you?
Fun.
For who?
Educational.
Is it?
Yeah.
It doesn't. I mean,
at one point we had these TV people because I was helping somebody shoot a special that they're doing, mm-hmm. and so it was about the Shroud, and so these TV people were following, and we were going out to dinner, and so I'm just talking like I normally do with my wife and I walking down the street, and we sit down at a table, and he's like, you know, there's a TV show in just this on what just happened. And I said, what do you mean? And he's like, just your commentary was...
your running commentary
remarkable.
Walking through the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I meant every word of it. I don't even know what I said, but I meant every word of it.
Every word of it.
Even if it causes war.
Well, because you were in Italy, and you were in Milan at one point.
Yeah, for a couple of days, yeah.
This is, you know, one of the centers of
fashion.
Our fashion world.
Yeah, yeah.
While the Met Gala was going on back here.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and they're tied together. I did a monologue today on radio about... Coco Chanel.
You have to tell the story. This is incredible. Now, you know me. I watched like every World War II documentary possible. I didn't know this story about Coco Chanel.
Because you don't care don't care about the Nazis. That's why.
No, it's not that. It's I don't care about fashion, I think. Maybe that's it. But
they're so intertwined. They're so deeply intertwined.
They are. Because you were the first person who told me about Hugo Boss. That the Hugo Boss...
They're the ones that made the SS uniforms.
SS uniforms. And I remember I had the same reaction every single time you do one of these things, which is like, holy crap, we're going to get sued. And I go on the internet and try to check it.
Yeah.
And then you were right about the Hugo Boss uniforms.
Right. Uh-huh.
And also right about Coco Chanel. And I did the exact same thing as you were telling that story.
Really?
Holy crap, we're going to get sued. Oh my gosh, it's actually true.
No, no. Coco Chanel was a despicable human being. Okay. So she is this fashion designer and, you know, makes $5,000 purses or whatever the hell she makes.
Right.
I just out of spite, I always call her the channel store.
Okay. I'm sure
Wearing channel, you know, because they love it.
They love it.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm walking with my wife, you know, down the street, and I see the channel store, and I'm like, oh, let's go see if we can find some Nazi propaganda in there. And my wife is like, please, can we not? And I'm like, no, it's just that she was a Nazi. And she's like, I've heard it. No, please. She's heard the story many times. She lives with me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But when I say she heard the story, she's never listened to the
story.
But she has
heard.
There's a difference. Mm-hmm. There is a difference. Mm-hmm. And so the Nazis come marching in to Paris, France. She's got, you know, the Coco Chanel house or whatever it is. She has, you know, Chanel number 5. It's a new perfume and everything else. And everybody loves Coco Chanel until the Nazis arrive. And she's like, you know, these guys aren't that bad, really.
That's not a great take in that moment.
Right.
Any moment, frankly.
So, you know, most of the designers, they just close down and they're like, we're not making anything for anybody right now. But not Coco Chanel. She decides she's going to move into the hotel where all the Nazis are. And so she decides she's going to start designing dresses for the Nazi wives, okay? And then she sleeps around a little bit with a few Nazis, but who didn't back then?
I mean, I think a lot of people didn't, but she did.
Right, she did. Mm-hmm. So she decides she's going to, you know, sleep with, in particular, one Nazi who could do her some favors. For instance, you know, they passed the, you know, Jews shouldn't own anything, and... She had made a deal with a Jewish family, very prominent French Jewish family, that funded Chanel No. 5.
The signature product to this day.
To this day. Chanel No. 5.
Yeah.
Just think Nazi. Just think Hitler. Boy, Hitler smells a little like Chanel No. 5. So she does this. The Nazis come in power, and they're like, hey, Jews can't really own anything. So she goes to the Nazis and like, you know who owns Chanel No. 5 with me? You should get them, these Jews over here. And so she sicks the Nazis on these Jews that her business partner.
Yeah. And she claims, by the way, discrimination in this process. That's the reason.
Yeah.
She's been discriminated
against
by the Jews.
She's just a white French woman that has been discriminated against by these Jews. So the Jews were smart enough to go, I saw you coming a million miles away. And they transferred their ownership to somebody else. And then after the war... You know, she's done all kinds of stuff. She actually went to Spain and was supposed to meet with Hitler. I'm sorry, with Churchill over in Spain to try to get Winston Churchill to broker a deal with Hitler so that he would do a peace deal. okay, which would have left the Nazis in power.
Is it fair to call her a Nazi spy?
Yeah, Nazi spy. She was known as a Nazi spy. So the war is over. She's exposed. Everybody knows it. Everybody's like, oh, yeah, she was sleeping with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. Okay. Got all kinds of favors from the Nazis. She starts to see that they're just rounding people up and shooting them if they were collaborators. So she's like, I've got to go to Switzerland for some. I love the Alps. So she moves to the Alps until like 1956. Mm-hmm. She gets Chanel number 5 back. And she puts together a new show from Switzerland, but it's French couture. And she convinces Vogue magazine. Vogue in Paris won't do it. Okay, they know she's a Nazi. But Vogue America, the people that started the Met Gala in 1948, same people, they decided they were going to whitewash her. And so they brought her out on a new collection and said, the little black dress. Every woman says, sure, I have a little black dress. That's because the people that were whitewashing the Nazi with the little black dress, you know, it should be, oh, you got a little black dress. Where's the little red armband? Because that's what it was. That, and they just raved that she would use tweeds and a jersey fabric.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't know that. You didn't tell that
part of
the story.
And they were like, you know, I mean, yeah,
it's jersey fabric.
She was
though.
Rounding up Jews, but she was using jersey fabric to do it. I mean, it's beautiful. That's the Met Gala people.
They are the ones whitewashed
Vogue. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that whitewashed her and said, "Yep, she was a Nazi, but look what she. I mean, she's a fashion icon."
But tweed.
But I mean, that is tweed. Really. Whenever anybody says that about Donald Trump, he's a Nazi. Just say. But tweed.
It really is interesting because she did. This was not like a passing alliance, right?
No.
That, you know, because you had obviously Germany was a big country. It was a big economy. Many businesses did business with the Nazis. They shouldn't have. But no. we overlook a lot of that at this point.
No.
This was a big one, though.
No, she was deeply in bed. She put her money on the winning side. Ah, it turns out they didn't win.
Mm.
But she was putting her money on the winning side. It's just like, what's his name? The former king of England that abdicated right before. He put his money on. I mean, he was in Spain trying to convince, who was it? Spain. I don't remember. Trying to convince, I think, Spain to enter the war to help the Nazis against France so they could go in. He had made a deal. The king of England had made a deal. Mm. Go march into England, put me in power, and I'll do your bidding for you. Okay? They don't hold him responsible. You know what happened after the war? They sent him to Bermuda. Hey, guess who's going to be the...
Sounds great.
The new guy in Bermuda. Okay? They didn't care. They didn't care. The Nazis were all over all the elites in Europe. They're still all over. They're still not fessing up to. When did Vogue magazine come out and go, you know what? That whole Nazi thing with Chanel Coco was probably pretty bad. Oh, I don't know. Never.
That's fair. I actually have a copy of Vogue where they did the same thing with the Syrian Assad's wife.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
When they did that? I have a copy of that magazine. They just had this glowing profile, and then, like, they were gassing people 10 minutes later.
Right. And I mean, they did that. Look what they did to Melania Trump. I mean, it's no comparison here, but look how they took down Melania Trump.
Yeah.
One of the most beautiful, gracious first ladies ever.
Sure.
Because they called her a Hitler or her husband Hitler, and they should know what a Nazi is like. They have some experience with them. Because of that, they just destroyed her.
Well, I have apparently more Nazi documentaries to watch. Maybe one with you hosting it, walking through the streets of city. I would watch this show. I think that sounds fantastic.
There is a great, it's not a documentary. It was a Netflix or Amazon or one of these series on Christian Dior. Christian Dior was actually a hero of France. I didn't know anything about Christian Dior. His sister was actually put into a concentration camp, and one of the worst ones, the one for women, I can't remember, in Germany, you know the name. But she was put into the concentration camp because she was fighting for the underground. And he did everything he could to just stay neutral, stay out of it. Mm-hmm. But he hated the Nazis. and what he went through. He's the guy. I mean, you wouldn't have known Christian Dior before the war. He was just somebody else, a designer for somebody else. After the war, he wanted his own design firm, and he actually was a legitimate war hero. Didn't know anything about him.
Well, despite the fact that we're in your studio, they're telling me you need to wrap and get on to other stuff. So Glenn Beck, his
bigger names.
New special
bigger
coming
names.
Up tonight. We didn't talk about it at all, but it's on at 9 p.m. Central. Best way to watch
it. Yeah, don't miss it. It's really, really good tonight.
Blaze TV account, studiosamerica.com will get you there. Use the code STU. You get $20 off your subscription. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn. Und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
And now it's time for another edition of, wait, it wasn't already? Because this is one of those things, if you're a parent, you know this, my son needed Advil at school for something, and like, God forbid, that process is incredible, right? Like, it's like you're sending him there with heroin. It's bizarre the way this is treated for very basic medications. Well, it's even crazier in New Jersey, as you might expect. The over-the-counter medication will now be allowed in New Jersey schools without a doctor's note. You might say, okay, well, doctor's note, medicine, all right, maybe. Like, I don't know, do you need a doctor's note for Advil? I mean, it kind of seems silly, but okay. I understand that there's concerns there. Now, this was everything up until including sunscreen. Your kids could not put sunscreen on out in outdoor events unless they got a note from a doctor. Now they're going to allow it apparently to happen in school as long as they have parents' permission. So that's wonderful. It's just New Jersey being New Jersey. Wall Street firms talk about diversity and inclusion, but never seem to include viewpoints from middle America. You know, behind all the fancy investment terms and the, you know, all the marketing that they throw out there at you, these portfolios a lot of times are just actively supporting causes that undermine what you believe in, faith and family and freedom. Constitution Wealth offers an alternative approach for patriots who want their money aligned with their principles. Kind of seems like a basic thing, but it's true. They've got a whole team of financial advisors. They specialize in creating investment strategies that support companies that, you know, you believe in, that support American values, but also give you returns that you need. They recognize that financial success and moral consistency can work hand in hand. With personalized strategies, clients can pursue their financial goals while standing firm on their convictions. In today's divided nation, where you invest is mattering, I think, just as much as what you invest in. Your portfolio should reflect the America you believe in. Visit constitutionwealth.com/blaze. Get a free consultation today. Check this out. It's constitutionwealth.com/blaze. Constitution Wealth is a registered investment advisor. You should review your Constitution Wealth disclosures at constitutionwealth.com to understand services and fees. All investing involves risk, including the risk of loss. I'm a client of the firm, and this is a paid endorsement. My opinions, as always, however, are my own. I'm joined now by Brandon Morse. He's senior editor at Red State and host of Brandon Morse is a Brand Risk, which you don't normally want to say about yourself, but it seems to be working out very well. He's over on Rumble. Brandon, how's it going?
Not bad at all, man. Good to be here.
Blaze alum.
Yes.
You know, gone into great things at Red State, your own podcast and all this. Congratulations for all
your
success.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And since I've been, I got married, I had a kid.
Jeez.
Yeah, I know. I've just been
that
really busy.
That too. I mean, the podcast is obviously the big attraction,
for
but
sure,
the marriage
yeah.
and the kid is nice too. So
yeah,
congratulations.
We had,
it's great to hear that everything's going well. I wanted to bring you in because you kind of have an interesting window into a community that I don't really have a great sense of, which is the gaming community.
Yeah.
And, you know, I, as a kid, grew up playing tons and tons of games. You know, I'll still dive in for a little Madden or MLB The Show here and there, but, like, I'm not as involved in the day-to-day and all the developments. And there was sort of an interesting controversy on the right recently as to whether the gaming industry is as crazy as so many other industries seem to be. And, like, I think, you know, you point this out in one of your articles, the gaming industry is conservative movement's best friend. It just doesn't know it yet. You point out that, like, there's some truth to, there's some crazy elements of the gaming industry, But maybe that's not the right way for conservatives to think about it.
No, I mean, for a long time, conservatives have been told that, you know, gaming rots your brain, you know, people become obsessed and addicted, and, you know, it's just full of nonsense and horrible things. You know, they're often, you know, they use GTA as a, you know, Grand Theft Auto,
sure, yeah,
as an example of why people shouldn't play video games at all. But I would argue that the gaming industry is actually so much deeper than many people, especially conservatives, tend to understand. Gaming, especially the gaming subculture, is probably one of the largest in the world, and it encompasses so many types of people, religious, races, nationalities. And what's funny is that gaming has the ability to bring all these people together in ways that many other subcultures don't. They just can't. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, conservatives should really pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. You know, the radical left has infiltrated nearly everything, you know, especially entertainment-wise. But the one thing that they haven't been able to fully conquer is the gaming industry, because gamers largely do not allow it to happen.
Yeah.
Now, you could say, yeah, you know, many of the corporate studios have become very woke, like many corporate things have. But the gaming industry is so large that there is a thriving indie industry that sometimes even eclipses the major gaming industry. And the gamers in particular are very used to going out and wanting to have fun, find that escapism. So whenever they are actually preached at or told, you know, that they're horrible, whatever, they take their business, they go to the indie industry to actually pick up a game that is actually fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, the woke corporate industry tends to falter and fail. You see it happening right now with, you know, Sweet Baby Inc., you know, it was which has infected the corporate woke industry. And there is a movement titled Gamergate 2 right now.
Yeah.
That is currently making many developers regret ever wanting to work with Sweet Baby Inc. Because they wokeify their games, they make them not as fun, not cool, and gamers walk away and they go and they play something like Helldivers 2, which is an independent studio created game from a Swedish studio called Arrowhead Studios, and it's become something of a cultural sensation. So when it comes to video games, the woke left is actually fighting on the back foot.
You mentioned Gamergate 2. Let's go back to Gamergate 1, because this actually, it's probably a term that people, if you're online, you've seen this term around, you don't really know what the hell it is.
Yeah.
But it kind of was a precursor to a lot of the cultural battles that we wound up fighting. Can you go back and explain this to if they don't remember it?
So Gamergate 1 is probably one of the largest losses the left, the radical left, has ever taken. It began because gamers simply wanted ethics in gaming journalism. That's really what they asked for. And the gaming journalists said, no, you are going to be preached at. We're going to tell you that you're racist and homophobic, and we're going to try to influence all these studios into becoming woke themselves. And Gamergate ended up being a consumer revolt, is what it was, and one that actually cost the gaming industry and many of the, I should say the corporate gaming industry, and many of the woke journalist outlets a lot of money. Some of them closed down. In fact, one of them is on the verge of closing down right now. One of the most popular ones called Kotaku.
Yeah,
you've heard of that.
Yeah.
Kotaku is on death's door right now because, you know, back then in 2014 when the first Gamergate started, they said, we are, gamers are no longer our audience. You know, they're embarrassing, they're horrible. And we said, okay. And we left.
Huh.
So there's no one around reading them anymore.
And then they gave that advice to Bud Light and try to get them.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're like, oh, wait, let's hire those guys.
Can you believe that?
it seems like when you call your audience hicks and rubes, and they don't seem to like it all that much, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, no, it is kind of weird. I think that they expected to steamroll a lot of us. You know, there's a YouTuber named Razor Fist, and he brought up a really good point. You know, the Marxist left has been wanting to overtake everything entertainment, but for a very long time, they overlooked the gaming industry because it just, you know, it was a toy for kids. You know,
right.
Didn't have to worry about that. Then soon, gaming actually overtook movies, it overtook music. In fact, the music and movie industries combined can't hold a candle to what the gaming industry earns. So now it's a cultural force unto itself that the radical left is late to the party on. And because of that, it has not been able to infect a lot of minds. Gamers are one of the last bastions of, I would say, real intellectual, ideological independence.
That's, I mean, it, for that reason, I mean, you have a lot of people who are voting. You have a lot of people who have political influence. All this ties back to the issues we talk about every day.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, and this is why, you know, many conservatives need to understand and see gamers for what they are. You know, I mean, these are people who slay dragons as a hobby. You know, they fight and they fight. And whenever they lose, they press continue and they fight more, mm-hmm. you know, and that's one of the reasons that they're not being overcome by this, I mean, amalgamation of woke corporate, you know, journalistic nonsense, this access media that keeps trying to tilt everything in their favor and introduce their ideology, and they're just not succeeding well. Mm. And it's because gamers fight, and they fight hard.
How do you look at the state of our culture generally in the United States right now?
You know, generally, I would say that it is in a bad state, but I can't say that it's going to stay that way forever. I think that the pendulum is starting to swing the other way. Mm. You can kind of see that right now in the way that various studios are faltering and failing and trying to recoup by changing course a little bit. There are currently wars happening. I would say Disney is a very good example of this. Right now, Nelson Peltz is trying to restore the magic. That's his movement right now. By getting him and one other guy on the Disney board, Disney is trying to stop that from happening. The vote happens on April 3rd. But it looks like more and more people, stockholders specifically, are kind of gearing themselves up to vote for Peltz. And if Peltz takes over with Trian Partners and gets on the board, they can really make some really great changes for Disney. And that, I think, is a sign, going to be a big sign of a turn in the culture, a turn of in the entertainment culture, of going from this destructive ideological extremism to something more American, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, because I think I was thinking about this when you go back and you watch like old school commercials from like the 80s and the 90s. Yeah. And you see, like, you know, its quality is job one, right? Like, there's almost this obsessive focus on quality. Like, they make the people at the factories, like, they've got no other life. They don't care about their families. They don't care about they don't care about politics. All they care about is making this machine the best possible. All they care about is their customers. Yeah. And, like, there's been a real reversal of that over time where it's now like, well, we don't really care about what you're doing. What we care about is this higher ideological concept. And, I mean, a lot of that's just, you know, BS marketing. But like the change in marketing is real. Like it's I don't know if they think this is working on people, but continually as we watch this process play out, it feels like they're realizing the opposite is true. I mean, Boeing is a good example of that. Where he's like, yeah. I don't know, focus on your planes.
Yeah, no, there was actually, it's funny that you mentioned Boeing, because there was a recent article on Fox News that said that many customers who book on Kayak and websites like that, there's an option that you can say, what kind of plane do you want to fly on? And they are not clicking on Boeing. Wow. They are clicking off of it because they're scared.
Yeah.
They don't want to get on Boeing planes anymore because of DEI and ESG. Now, you mentioned the marketing and stuff. A lot of it is virtue signaling because they want to be seen being the good guy. Mm. But some of this is forced. You know, you have companies like BlackRock attempting to force many companies into obeying certain or checking certain boxes, you know, for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And you get Dylan Mulvaney trying to pimp Bud Light,
right?
You know, and it's backfiring in a big way for many reasons, not just Boeing, Bud Light. Many other companies are having to suffer from that too. And so I think that the more customers actually revolt, the more that eventually, you know, they're going to be forced to withdraw from these ESG, DEI ideas and actually go back to what you mentioned earlier, which was the let's focus on making the best product. Because really, ultimately, that's the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
You don't need to be seen. I don't go to the store and check, you know, whether or not, you know, a company is supporting my favorite cause. You know, I don't go and buy, an apple and think, man, I really hope the person who grew this apple really loves high speed rail. You know, it's dumb. I just want an apple, man. You know, that's it. And I think that we're going to get there.
Yeah. It's Jennifer Say calls it normie capitalism.
Yes.
And that's what I want. I just want the normie capitalism that we grew up with, at least.
Yeah. Let me be weird on my terms.
Yes, exactly. You know? It was interesting. I was watching... I mentioned the story once before, but I was watching the most recent Ricky Gervais special on Netflix. And Ricky Gervais is really funny. He's always really funny. The special was really funny.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. It was the first time I remember watching someone on a primetime outlet like that on Netflix doing something that was anti-woke. And it didn't quite feel dangerous to me anymore. Like, yeah. It didn't feel like, oh, this guy's going to get canceled tomorrow. This guy's going to get blown out. Now, he's Ricky Gervais. He kind of has a lot of leeway.
Right.
But, like, I do feel like that pendulum is coming back at least a little bit. Where are we in that process?
I mean, yeah, I think the pendulum is, I would say, on the upswing now, coming out from the middle of it, because, like you just said, like, remember when Dave Chappelle released that comedy special and everyone just went nuts?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was something that we are, back then was shocking. Now it's not. Now Ricky Gervais says it, and, you know, I remember reading some articles saying, yeah, it was funny.
It
wasn't shocking anymore. That wasn't really the shocking part wasn't the big part. And you kind of also see this in the gaming industry. Now games are being released, and there is a guy who created a curation list on Steam, which is a games marketplace. And on that curation list, he actually puts, his name is Cabrutus Rambo, he's from Brazil. He puts on games that were created with the help of Sweet Baby Inc. And now that he has that curation list, which now has over 330,000 people on it, you'll see companies now going to Cabrutus Rambo and be like, hey, yeah, we did work with them in the past, we're not anymore. Please take us off this list. They don't want to be associated with that ESG, DEI nonsense, with that leftist nonsense. So yeah, it's coming up now. People are walking away. And that's really great for our culture, because I really think that if we're going to get back to normalcy of any kind, the culture first has to change. But, you know, maybe it has to get a little worse before it gets better. But I mean, I see better on the horizon.
I've seen the Sweet Baby Inc. included in some of the commentary on this. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Because I don't know much about them, but they're a game maker that just does a lot of woke stuff? Or?
So what they are is whenever, they're kind of like the mob.
Okay.
They go in and they're like, oh, I see you've got a nice studio here. It'd be a real shame if someone canceled it.
Ah.
We're
very familiar here at The Blaze with those types of things. Yeah.
So basically what Sweet Baby Inc. is an advisory company.
Okay.
And they go into studios that are making games and they say, all right, let me take a look at your, and by the way, they're usually hired either by force or because the developers themselves have that woke ideology. And they'll go in and they'll say, I don't like this character. We need to race swap or change them up so that, you know, race swap, gender swap, whatever it takes make them fit more of the woke ideology that we have. They'll change up storylines. They'll change up dialogue until it is basically a bunch of checked boxes, a bunch of checked boxes for the woke left. And, you know, the bad thing about that, like, you know, obeying woke ideology when it comes to entertainment is that it all starts to look the same after a while. And the stories don't make sense after a while, or they're just kind of like annoyingly stupid, you know?
Yeah.
They're not deep anymore. They don't really have substance. And that's why, you know, that's what Sweet Baby Inc. does, though, is they introduce that that checkbox nonsense and ruin games. And that's one of the reasons why gaming companies are now saying, no, we don't want this. We saw what happened to Remedy with Alan Wake 2. We saw what happened to Kill the Justice League. All Sweet Baby Inc. games that they worked on and ruined.
Mm.
And they could have been great, probably. They probably at one point in time were great.
As a gamer, too, you're going there for, like, the most extreme experience, right? Like, you want the most powerful weapon. You don't want some moderate weapon. You don't want it watered down.
I'm just going there for good escapism.
Yeah.
That's really what it boils down to. I'm just going there to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not coming there to be preached at.
Right.
I'm not going to pay $60 so you can tell me that I'm a homophobe.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's not what I'm here for. So, yeah.
I'll do it for $40. I'll call you a homophobe over and over again for $49.99. No problem. Brandon Morse, senior editor at Red State. Be sure to check out his show. Brandon Morse is a brand risk over on Rumble. Brandon, great to see you, man. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, brother.
When you join Blaze TV, you're supporting a media ecosystem that answers to viewers, not corporate interests. You get documentaries that investigate rather than manipulate. You get analysis that clarifies rather than confuses. You get commentary that respects your intelligence. It costs just $8 a month with the promo code STU. It's less than a movie ticket for unlimited access to truth. So go to blazetv.com/stu or studoesamerica.com. Use the code STU. You'll get $20 off right now. The annual plan, I think it's worth it. Check it out, blazetv.com/stu.